I can be sitting in my office and just look out the window and see humpbacks moving around in the bay and moving their tails. So that's tail slapping onto the water surface. Often it's a socializing behavior. And it's exactly like what you see in the documentaries. There is such an abundance of marine mammals and top, so they are the top predators around here because the waters are so productive. There's so much phytoplankton, which are these photosynthesizing algae, which are able to bloom and create the most intense phytoplankton blooms worldwide because we have 24 hours of daylight during the summer.
Welcome to Leading with Social Impact podcast, and I'm your host Shreyas. Each episode, we will try to find out the inspiring solutions to the global challenges and problems by listening to innovators, entrepreneurs, intrapreneurs, and change makers of the world. Let us get inspired together to create a positive social impact and reach UN Sustainability Development Goals. Keep listening, Leading with Social Impact. Hello, everyone. Today, we have with us Nadia Frontier. Nadia is working as a marine biologist in Antarctica with British Antarctic Survey. She has been living in Rotorua Research Station for the last 4 months and is due to stay there until next year. The focus of her research is to improve our understanding about Antarctic ecosystems and how they function. She mainly does this by using diving as a tool to access her underwater office. Great to have you on the show, Nadia.
Oh, thank you so much, Shreyas, for that lovely introduction.
So I have to say I'm super excited to learn about your experiences there in the White Continent. And I'm hoping we don't have any internet issues. Like you woke up quite early in the morning today, like 7 a.m. to record this podcast. So yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, let's hope this is the time where everyone is still asleep. So hopefully we should have the best bandwidth.
Let's hope so. So yeah, you moved there almost in the mid of a pandemic. Like I said, like you moved there about 4 months ago. How was that transition? Was it difficult to move there? Because I know that Antarctica was the last continent probably to confirm about the COVID cases. So how was that transition from your place to Antarctica?
Yes, exactly, Shreyas. It was quite an interesting one. I actually applied for the job in March, and then I was quite surprised to learn that I actually had got the job and that it was still possible to send researchers to Antarctica amongst this pandemic. So I found out late in the summer, about June, July time. And then from August, we started a pretty intense program of training. So we did various boat training, diving training, firefighting, and learning how to operate a crane, for example. Oh. So there was lots of training centers all around the UK, in the south, in Coventry, and we had to use hire cars to get to these trainings and observe very strict social distancing. So I was meeting my colleagues for the first time that I would live with in Antarctica whilst very closely observing that those social distances and going out for dinners and not being able to interact in the way that you would. So that was quite an interesting experience right at the heart of a pandemic. And the plans kept evolving of exactly how to get us to Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So the situation of COVID was becoming increasingly worse, and legislation and restrictions on flying were tightening. So it looked that the option to get us down to the bases in Antarctica, so there's quite a few research stations along the West Antarctic Peninsula. There's a British base at the north of the West Antarctic Peninsula, which is rather a research station. So this is where I work. But on our journey down, we also had to pass through some sub-Antarctic islands, such as South Georgia, and then another island off South Georgia, which is called Bird Island, and then Cygni again, which is further south. So the British Antarctic Survey decided the best way to refuel all these stations and change out the staff, so replacing the old wintering team with the new wintering team, was to send a research vessel. So that is the James Clark Ross, the British Antarctic Survey's boat, from the UK all the way to Antarctica with all the staff on. So we sailed for 8 weeks on board the ship, and then conducted relief and cargo operations at all the different bases. But so it was a fantastic way to travel and actually a great experience. So normally you would fly from the UK, Auckland Islands, or South Africa, because they are either two of those areas of air bridges where you can then take a smaller plane onto the Antarctic continent.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, the ship was the best and most secure way. So after completing weeks of quarantine, then we boarded the ship and sailed down and got to see this amazing transition going through the equator and then coming on the polar regions and seeing icebergs emerge in the landscape and documenting wildlife changing. It was an incredible journey. So one benefit of the pandemic, ironically.
Yeah. So like it's quite crazy like how you got to experience all this. So is there anything that you probably learned or experienced during this pandemic that you would like to share? Maybe a positive thing that you think came out of this pandemic?
A positive thing that came out of the pandemic personally for me was seeing this seasonal change. Mm-hmm. So first when I was at home and just spending one time in the same area during the pandemic, that was great because you could see like the river changing, the mayflies come in May. I learned to identify lots of different bird songs and was really accustomed to the wildlife changing around me. And then that real great interest that I started to develop during the pandemic before mm-hmm. I went to Antarctica then continued during the trip on the ship. And I actually got to spend time with ornithologists, so people who study birds who mm-hmm. were working at the sub-Antarctic islands. So that was, otherwise we wouldn't get to meet them because we'd all fly down separately. So getting to spend 8 days with them whilst I had developed this really strong interest in birds, we just spent most of the days on the Monkey Island, which is the highest point of a ship, mm-hmm. looking out to sea and observing lots of different types of birds. And then I had loads of identification guides. So we'd sit together in the evenings and then talk about what species we had discovered. Wow. And that was really positive. And it also worked on the whale front. So there was a few marine biologists on the ship with me, and they had a keen interest in identifying different species of whales and dolphins and porpoises. So again, mm-hmm. we had some pretty good camera lenses, so we managed to capture photos of the dorsal fins, which is key identifiable features for different marine mammals. Wow. And then we'd ponder over them in the evening, like what whale was just made this massive recording of all the different species we found. So we ended up recording about 600 observations during our travel.
Yeah, that sounds super fascinating. And like you said, like talking about Antarctica, the climate cycles are also quite different, right? So you would have observed that. And so right now, like you said, it's winter now. Winters are starting in April and May. How are the temperatures there in general?
So the temperatures are quite variable. At the moment, we are just at the start of the winter. So today is -4 degrees. Mm-hmm. And with the wind chill factor, that contributes massively to reducing the temperatures. So although it's 4 degrees actual recorded air temperature from the weather station, mm-hmm. with the wind chill, we've got about -14 as a feeling of how cold yeah. it is. So there have been some days where it feels like -20.
Wow.
But then the air temperature is probably about -8 degrees at those points. So it will continue to drop, especially as we get the polar nights where the sun doesn't rise above the horizon at all. And there's only a faint light of twilight during essentially a 2 month period. And in those times, the temperature can be about -30 degrees.
Wow, that sounds crazy. Like, I mean, I'm currently in Sweden and here also like the temperature drops quite a lot. But of course, I mean, Antarctica is altogether a different ballgame. But yeah, now let's start talking about your research work. But before we talk about your research work, current findings and life at the research station, let's talk about your journey as a marine biologist. How did you end up in Antarctica? How did you get started? Is that something that you always wanted to become, a marine biologist?
Great question. So when I was at school, I was in that period of choosing what to study at university, and I wasn't quite sure I wanted to do something down the biology route because that was the subject that really captivated me at school. I loved learning about how things functioned and conducting experiments. So that was something that I knew I wanted to pursue. I was looking at different avenues. And then my dad just said to me at dinner one day, why don't you do marine biology? And I thought, that's such a great idea. I didn't even think about that as a subject. I'd spent a lot of time in Brittany in France with my nan every holiday, and she would take us to the coast. We'd press seaweed, we'd look at different shells, and that, I guess, that seed was planted in me from a very young age, and then that was revived as actually studying as a subject. So immediately went to lots of open days and yeah, found Plymouth University, which was a fantastic coastal city, and offered scientific diving as a big part of the course. So I thought, oh, that'd be fantastic. Before I went to university, I worked in Tanzania with a company called Frontier. So same, yeah, same as my surname, and learned to dive there because I just wanted to experience what it would be like to dive before I plunged into this scientific diving course as a marine biologist at university. And it was fascinating to work with an organization called Frontier, and we were working on the Mafia Islands, which is the east to the east of Tanzania, and we were surveying a marine park, and I was just absolutely fascinated by the diversity and abundance of life and using different tools to map and monitor these underwater habitats. And I knew it was something that I wanted to pursue at university. So that definitely gave me a flavor in building up to this idea of being a marine biologist. And then studying marine biology at university was such a amazing door opening experience. I just learned so much about the natural world that had always really fascinated me, just being surrounded in nature, and especially being by the coast, but actually understanding what species live there, what they do, what are the pressures that govern and structure the animals that live in different habitats. And we got to go to South Africa and do a field trip and look at the ecology of birds on salt plains, and again had the opportunity to conduct our own personal research projects. And every year at university, it just the realization that I wanted to be a scientist specializing in marine habitats was cemented more and more. And then in my first year, we had a lecturer who gave us a presentation about working on an Antarctic research station. And I was absolutely amazed that there was research stations that operated all year round and conducted scientific research. So I went back immediately and printed out the job description and had it on my wall for many years. And then each year I kind of built up my experience a little bit because there was lots of different criteria. For example, specific microscopy work, so looking under using microscopes and taxonomic keys to identify different species, and get lots of experience in scientific diving and extracurricular projects. So yeah, definitely dedicated a lot of the university time.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think like you also built up your skills for that particular job, right? So that's definitely a big step. But talking about Antarctica, I mean, it is such a big decision, especially to stay away from home for a long time, right? Although the pandemic hasn't given many people opportunity to go back home, like even I haven't been home for almost 2 years now. But still, was it a factor at all that you considered, or going to Antarctica was just a clear choice?
A clear choice. When I got offered the job, despite having spent quite a lot of time at home with my family, it was just clear that I definitely wanted to go to Antarctica. This was such a unique experience. And leaving home was really difficult because it was at a time where there was so much uncertainty and you didn't know what world I'd come back to. So actually thinking back to that decision and saying goodbye to my friends who were really struggling with jobs was actually, although I knew I wanted to do it was a much harder place to then leave this society. And yeah, it was quite a tricky time leaving, and knowing that although you're going to experience something amazing, there's so many people that are left behind at home,
True.
in much of a different situation to you. So
Yeah, for sure, it's such a big step. But like you have been there for 4 months now, right? So how is the life at the research station? How does your everyday there look like?
yeah, so that is correct. We arrived here in December, and it has been a really at the start, we arrived in the height of the summer season. So because we're in the southern hemisphere, the seasons are reversed to what you'd have in the northern hemisphere. And we had a very busy month of a handover period because we sailed down on the ship. The the period in which you transition with the old wintering team was reduced to, it's about 3 to 4 months. So it was intense to learn everything and take on these new skills. So the start of the life on base was a lot of understanding and familiarization and becoming aware of how different machinery operated, how to conduct polar diving operations, and understanding how the station functions. So interestingly, because you are contributing and living on a small station, be really multifaceted and contribute to lots of different tasks. So, as well as doing your job, I would say that 80% of my work time is my job, and then the other 20% would be the station life. So that can range from contributing to cooking days when the chefs take days off. You would spend a whole day in the kitchen, and then you could cook for, in the height of summer, 120 people. So you generally have two or three people working in the kitchen. That's a great experience. Cleaning, also conducting fire cover. So there's quite a few planes here that conduct research into the deep field. So they take glaciologists or people that are drilling for different minerals and geologists. So those planes regularly fly into the field. So there needs to be people on fire cover in case that there's an incident with the plane, for example. And we also do this with the boats. The boats are always ready in case they need to launch when the planes are coming back in onto the runway. So there's many other responsibilities. There's a mooring team that brings in the ship. So in the peak of summer, there's so many things going on, and it's crazy. So our day-to-day life was starting at 8:30 and we'd finish at 6 o'clock, and we'd work on Saturdays as well. So it was the summer was definitely a period that was quite consuming. But what was great is that we've got these field guides. They are very experienced and they understand the local environment and where there are different crevasses. So these are slots in ice sheets, and we always have to be roped up when we're walking in areas that haven't been surveyed. So if we have a field guide, we can go out and actually experience the local scenery around us and try out new activities such as climbing or even abseiling into a crevasse, going skiing and snowboarding around the local travel area. So there's lots of recreational opportunities and a chance to build skills about how to like essential field training at the same time. So yeah, that was the summer season.
Nice. So just about how many people live there during summer or during winter?
Yeah, so in the summer this year there was 100 people, and then there were some people in the field. So that about the maximum capacity on station was 120 this summer if everyone was here together. And then in the winter, so the winter started mid-March, so that was only 6 weeks ago. And a ship left with all the summer people. And now we are 23 people on station. So that, Shreyas, that was such a big change that day when the ship left, and then suddenly everyone was standing on the wharf. I mean, everyone, the wintering team of 23 people. And we all just had this moment of looking around at each other like,
This
wow,
is it, yeah.
this is it. This is all we're going to know until probably about November time. So the winter period is lasting from March to November, and there's no airplanes and no ships.
Wow,
So
crazy.
therefore we cannot receive any post. All the fruit and veg that we were left with is all we have. We have to really make use of it until the end. But it's a much smaller team now, and the hours are down to wintering hours. So we don't have to work on Saturday anymore. And we work 9 to 5. But then you work other hours doing station responsibilities, but generally your job is 9 to 5.
But that's a big drop actually. Like 25% people are just there on the research station. So for sure it must have been like a big change on that day. But yeah, like, can you tell me a little bit about the underwater life there in Antarctica? Talking about your experience. I mean, how different is it from other places? Because based on my limited knowledge about Antarctica, the thing that excites me the most is the diverse marine life there, right? I mean, at least from the documentaries I've seen, like you have penguins, humpback whales, sea lions, and all these like different marine creatures. Were you able to find any of them during your explorations?
Hi, nice question. So yes, actually, what's quite fascinating is the marine mammals here, and that's what I'll start with first. So we have lots of humpback whales in the bay. So I can be sitting in my office and just look out the window and see humpbacks moving around in the bay and moving their tails. So that's tail slapping onto the water surface. Often it's a socializing behavior. And it's exactly like what you see in the documentaries. There is such an abundance of marine mammals and top, so they are the top predators around here because the waters are so productive. There's so much phytoplankton, which are these photosynthesizing algae, which are able to bloom and create the most intense phytoplankton blooms worldwide because we have 24 hours of daylight during the summer. So therefore, this productivity in the surface waters is driving an abundance of food, which supports baleen whales like the humpbacks that have got these plates that basically sift through the phytoplankton in the water. So we've encountered loads of them. And at the moment, they are now leaving. So because it's getting darker, there's less of that productivity. So the whales are now migrating north back to the tropics to their breeding grounds. So the humpback whales have already started actually trying to secure a mate. So the males are exhibiting lots of different songs. It's called trumpeting, where they are calling and trying to attract the females, and then they pair and they guard their female all the way to the hot breeding grounds in the tropics. So this is the behavior that we're witnessing right now. And every time we go out on the boat, you can almost be guaranteed to hear or see humpbacks. But in addition to humpbacks, this is the life that we're seeing from the boats. We also see Antarctic minke whales, which are a smaller whale, about 9 meters. They need to breathe every 15 minutes. So if there's lots of sea ice, we won't encounter the minke whales. But at the moment, we're seeing them move through patches of iceberg, and it's quite exciting when they come really close to the boat. And similarly, there's orca, so that's the killer whales, also known as. There's a resident group of orca. There's about 10 of them, and the males have got very, very tall fins, so you can see them distinctly. And there's been a few events where the orca have been hunting different species of seal, for example, crab eater seals and Weddell seals that are laying on these ice floes. And then the orca come out of the water and exhibit this spy hopping behavior where they lift their of the water and then they are actively hunting the seals. So it can be quite a messy affair. And so you can just be sitting eating lunch and then there's orca predating on seals. So you're just having a cup of tea whilst watching this amazing natural world unfold in front of you. And a great thing actually was, so we have leopard seals, which are very big. So they're seals, they're enormous and they're carnivores. They actively predate penguins and birds. So we were just going to our dive site the other day and a leopard seal was in the water destroying an Antarctic petrel. And then there was some bigger giant petrels. So they are like dinosaur looking birds, about a meter wingspan, a meter or two, and they are trying to dive bomb the leopard seal to try and access the food. So we could see this natural event happening in front of us, which was incredible, but unfortunate because as divers, leopard seals do present a problem to us because we should not be in the water with a leopard seal, as there has been some incidences in the past, and leopard seals can actively try and they could drag a diver down to deeper depths or confuse them for a penguin. So we can't be in the water with a leopard seal. So if we see a leopard seal, the same goes for orca, we can't dive. So yeah, although it's great to see them, sometimes I'm like, oh, go away.
It sounds fascinating. Like whenever you're saying like all these things, like I was just totally imagining it, but completely like I've just seen it in documentaries or like just Discovery channels, but looking at it live must be a tremendous experience. But now talking about your research work, how do you conduct the research there and like what kind of research activities you're currently doing there? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. So, although I've spoken a lot about marine mammals, actually, what I'm working on is not that at all. And under the water, so there's all it's amazing because you've got this white, bleak landscape with some seals and some orca. But then under the water, you've got this explosion of life and diversity and underwater colors. And actually, you asked me how different it is compared to other habitats. And here, the waters are so cold. And they're very isolated. So there's this Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which is an oceanic current, and it surrounds the Antarctic continent and it runs in a clockwise direction. So it actually acts as a barrier to prevent any life from other continents like South America and South Africa accessing these Antarctic habitats. And it also keeps the waters really cold. So the ocean here doesn't vary very much in temperature. It ranges from about minus 1.8 degrees in the heart of winter to positive 2 degrees. So there's only 4 degrees temperature variation. And in the tropics, for example, you could have much greater variation of a 10, 15 degree window. And then again, moving to, let's say, UK environments, the water temperature I have experienced ranging at least 20 degrees. So there's a huge variation there. But in Antarctica, we have very thermally stable waters. So that lends itself to lots of invertebrates, which are teeming on the sea floor. So a large part of my research is to understand how quickly different species of invertebrates grow. So invertebrates don't have a backbone, and they are able to tolerate these very cold waters, and often they're specially adapted. So there's this hypothesis that because the waters here are so cold that they can hold more oxygen. So oxygen is not a limiting factor to the growth of a lot of species. So we have this phenomena called giganticism, where a lot of, let's say, a sponge that you would normally know as quite a smaller size back in other habitats is actually enormous here. And the same goes for these sea spiders, which are actually what they say on the tin. Let's say in the UK, they're the size of your thumbnail. Here, they could be a good 10, 15 centimeters. So there's this explosion of life that is there's so much diversity because it's an isolated continent. So lots of animals can evolve and fill different niches, but they're also massive. So yeah, as I explained, the large part of my research is to understand how quickly they grow. So I use diving as a tool to monitor different underwater environments, underwater, sorry, dive sites, and then I can track the certain species, and I'm visiting them throughout the season and conducting measurements about their metabolism, how quickly they grow, what they're feeding on, and it all feeds into a big food web model, but understanding the energy transfer in the ecosystem.
This sounds really fascinating. And yeah, now let's talk about climate change, right? Like climate change is real and there is no denying that. So of course, there is some impact of climate change and that is also part of the research that you're doing there. Can you tell me a little bit about the current situation there? Like how has it changed from last couple of years? Like have you seen any a big change or something that you would like to share?
So, in terms of climate change, there has been a lot of research that's been conducted at the station since diving started in 1997. And over the last more than 20 years, there have been clear changes in the movement of icebergs. So, generally, icebergs are grounded into sea ice during the winter period. But the sea ice and the warmer temperatures around the West Antarctic Peninsula are causing a retreat of the sea ice, and there's less and less of it. So it's forming a lot later and it's lasting for a much shorter window. So that means that the icebergs that are normally trapped in the sea ice are actually free to move. So when icebergs are moving, they are scouring the sea floor. So just like trawler boats do that fish for for large and thick fish on the bottom of the seabed. So the icebergs having that same effect. It's just like dragging and destroying everything in its path on the bottom of the seafloor. So quite a lot of the research here has looked at the recovery and the resilience of Antarctic ecosystems with this increase of iceberg movement. And they've actually shown that the Antarctic systems are quite resilient, and they are able to rebound to a different state with this increased iceberg movement. So there's a lot of the Antarctic ecosystems can recover quite well. But then we've got these other pressures, such as increasing in temperatures are allowing other species that live further north to move south, and they could outcompete the species that are living in these environments. So there's a risk that we haven't seen it happening yet, but there is, it's on the cards that the ecosystem could be reshuffled. Another big thing is that with less of this ice covering, there's more productivity in the surface waters, because the ice can, without the ice, the water is receiving lots of sunlight, and therefore this phytoplankton bloom is lasting for longer. So more food is available to different animals and on, that live on the seafloor and depend on this surface productivity.
Yeah.
And that is that's an interesting change, because it's like it, there can be some benefits almost to the ecosystem, or a change. We're seeing a change, and we need to understand how that is going to affect the life here. Yeah.
Isn't the availability of food a good thing, in the sense, like, of course, I mean, because more ice is melting, but like, since there is availability of more food, more marine life can sustain. So is it like, how is that a problem? Like, I don't understand the technicalities of it, but can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Sorry, what I was actually trying to convey there is I was documenting the change and saying that although we have this increase in scouring event and destruction of the seabed habitats, as a on the flip side of that, with there being less ice, there's actually more productivity and more food that's accessing these ecosystems. So it is a good thing. So there's the thing with climate change is that it's such a multifaceted topic that we don't fully understand exactly what pressures and how it operates. So here is a perfect example. It can have a negative impact, but it can also have a positive impact on the seafloor. And the changes and exactly how this will restructure habitats is something that we are continuously documenting and conducting these long-term time series to understand, will species grow more? So if there's more food, potentially some species could become a lot more dominant and then outcompete the rarer species, or is this increase in food available to lots of different species or just certain ones that benefit from it? So
That is definitely this is something, such an important research work that is being currently conducted, because we need all this data to do this comparative study as well. So there is this Antarctic Treaty as well, right? Can you tell me, like, what is Antarctic Treaty? Like, what is the purpose of it?
Yes, so the Antarctic Treaty was signed by 12 different countries in 1959, and it was a pact that was ensuring that Antarctic resources wouldn't be exploited, and therefore operations such as drilling and mining would be kept to an absolute minimum on the Antarctic continent, and not even conducted at all. So that was ensuring the future and recognizing Antarctica as a hotspot for research and marine life, and freedom for scientific investigation and acting as a peaceful continent. So it binded lots of different countries together and led to this international scientific cooperation. And then as time went on, more and more countries started to sign it. So this is a treaty that is existing currently now. Mm-hmm. So although there's lots of different research bases from many different countries, we still recognize that the Antarctic environment cannot be exploited in ways that we do in other areas. So fishing is not allowed in most of the regions that are governed by the Antarctic Treaty. We have to respect wildlife. We can't conduct certain building and construction So yeah, it's a really good protection of the continent that lots of different countries do obey.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And also, like, I wanted to ask, has COVID impacted the current way of working for you there in the research center?
Actually, it has, because we have a lot less summer people that were here. So in I said there were 120 people, but in past years there have been up to 200 people on station, and there's many scientists that come and conduct lots of different research projects. And this year, at least from the marine science side, there was only four scientists here, as opposed to normally about 20. So we'd have like PhD students and master's students coming down and conducting their projects. But the scope of people that could come down here was a lot more limited because we had to come down here by ship. So actually that had a noticeable impact in that it was a relatively quiet season, and the research was only prioritized as essential work. So that's why I was able to come down here, because myself as the marine biologist and also the marine assistant, we contribute to these regular time series of surveying, documenting underwater change, and taking regular weekly or bi-weekly, depending on the season, water measurements using a sampling device. So we maintain that research, but people that were coming in and wanted to start new projects and do different things were not able to do that this year. So therefore the research capacity was definitely a lot limited, and the base was running on essential personnel that need to keep everything functioning, keep the generators on, the vehicles working. So they were prioritized. So I guess in that sense, science took a back seat this year. It was still able to continue. It didn't, when the pandemic started, British Antarctic Survey were thinking that actually conducting any science would be almost impossible. But we have still been able to maintain the crucial research. So that has impacted us. But apart from that, the life here, we are thinking a lot about people at home, and it just feels quite strange that we can't be with them. But it's actually, if I'm honest, it's quite easy to forget that a pandemic is underway, because we of course don't have to observe social distance in here. We've all quarantined, so we can just have normal, we can live this normal lifestyle. We've all experienced the start of the pandemic, and actually, yeah, moving here it's very different.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And clearly, I mean, it is so important that we need all these kinds of research work done in Antarctica as well, right? And also share it with people. That's very important as well. And there are like many parallel research activities that are currently being done in Antarctica, similar to your projects. So who funds these projects?
Yes, so a lot of the research here and the British Antarctic Survey is mostly funded by NERC, which is a government body. So that's the Natural Environment Research Council. And so British Antarctic Survey is essentially then government funded by this body, which contributes to research and innovation, and they fund lots of different scientific projects and university institutes. So they are a big funder, and that's how a lot of our research is able to operate here.
Oh, perfect. So if someone wants to read about your work, your experiences, where can they find that information?
So I have a blog, and I'll give you the link. So it's Nadia Frontier, so that's NADIAFRONTIER.blogspot.com. So that will give you an insight into what it's like to live on an Antarctic research station and the work that I'm doing. And then hopefully when I publish the research that I'm doing this year, those publications will be made available and linked onto that blog.
Perfect. So Nadia, what is your call to action for future change makers?
I would like future change makers to take a responsibility for the pristine habitats and environments that we currently have, and that remain untouched, and to keep them untouched, and to use pristine habitats that are far from human influence to also act as a model system as to how we need to revert other habitats. So areas that have been destroyed by fishing and pollution and habitat destruction, really, I would like change makers to take a leaf from really productive habitats and ecosystems that can support so much life, to replicate that into habitats and areas that have been really destroyed and under a lot of anthropogenic pressures. Yeah.
Wonderful. So yeah, finally moving on to what if questions. So these are the questions that I ask in every show. The first one, what if you had the power to change one thing in the world? What will it be?
Honestly, fishing practices. That is a massive concern of mine, that the way we fish is just depleting marine life at an alarming rate. And it doesn't just remove fish from the fishes from the ecosystem, but it's also destroying the habitats at the bottom, which are the seafloor organisms that provide shelter and nursery to lots of different species. So if I was to change one thing, it would be the way that we fish. And I would like that we adopt sustainable practices and are conscious of what we're doing to our environment. That's my that's one of the most important things, I believe.
Amazing. Yeah, I completely agree with you, and that is much needed change as well. Second one, what if you have to choose one sustainability development goal to work with throughout your life? Which one would you select and why?
So I would choose Sustainable Development Goal 14, which is life below water.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for you being a marine biologist, 14 is kind of a given. So
yeah, 14, working towards contributing to life below water and ensuring sustainable management practices.
Perfect. That was such a wonderful conversation. Thanks a lot, Nadia, for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Shreyas. I really enjoyed it, and great to speak to you.